Chapter 21.
Heaven, Remy murmured. Absolute heaven.
True to his word, upon returning to their Four Seasons villa, Sam had, after they'd shared a long hot shower, ordered first a sumptuous lunch of seafood salad, hot sourdough bread, and a tropical fruit bowl, then a pair of masseuses, who'd spent an hour giving them a hot stone massage before moving to deep tissue Swedish. Sam and Remy lay side by side on the veranda, the sheer curtains billowing around them in a light tropical breeze. Down the beach, the breakers gently washed in and out, nature's own lullaby. Sam, hovering on the edge of sleep, simply muttered, "This is living." The surprised couple they'd encountered upon their exit from the cave had in fact been Midwesterners. Mike and Sarah, from Minnesota, and on their honeymoon. After three tries, they'd answered Sam's "Where are we?" question. On Rum Key's northern coast between Junkanoo Rock and Liberty Rock. They had, by Sam's calculation, traveled some 9 miles along the underground river. Mike and Sarah had graciously offered to give them a ride, and a tow to the mini-sub, to which Sam had grown quite attached, down the coast in their rented boat. 42 hours after first touching down at Rum Key, Sam and Remy were back at their landing beach. Their host, the mysterious beachcomber, was nowhere to be seen, so they muscled the sub into the undergrowth and left a note on the hut's wall. "Please keep an eye on this. We'll be back for it." Sam had no idea exactly what he had planned, but it seemed wrong to simply abandon it. They then climbed aboard the Bonanza and headed for the main island and their hotel. Massages complete, Sam and Remy lay still for a while, dozing, then got up and went back inside. Having already given Selma a "We're okay" text message, Sam now called her and put her on speakerphone. He gave her a quick rundown of their cave odyssey.
"Well, no one can accuse the Fargos of taking mundane vacations," Selma replied. "I may have an answer to one mystery. Why, it was Kolkov who came after you. Rube called. Grigory Arkhipov was found dead in a Yalta parking lot. His hands and feet were missing. Amputation by shotgun. Rube told me to..."
"Tell us to be careful," Sam finished. "We are."
"The question is, how did Kolkov find you?"
"We've been wondering that ourselves."
"Did you check our..."
"No credit checks on the account you used, and all our computers here are firewalled, so I doubt they got your itinerary that way. Same with your passport records. The government is tight with those." Remy said, "That leaves airlines or..."
"Some lead they have that we don't," Sam finished.
"But that begs the question, why hadn't they already raided the caves?"
"I'll keep working on it," Selma said, "but I don't think it came from our end."
"Until we know, we'll assume the worst and keep looking over our shoulders," Remy said.
"Good. So, about this submarine..."
"The UM-77, Sam offered.
"Right. You want me to get it back here?"
"We'd better," Remy replied, "or Sam is going to pout." "It's a piece of history," he grumbled. They'd agreed that once this was all over, they would tell both the German and the Bahamian governments about the sub pens and let the two sort it out among themselves.
"And if no one wants it?" Remy had asked.
"We'll put it above our mantle." Remy had groaned.
"That's what I was afraid of."
Now, on the phone, Selma said, "I'll work it out. Might take a few days, but I'll get it back here." "So, Kolkov got the bottle?"
"Afraid so.
Any news for us?"
"Yes, in fact, a few things I think you'll find interesting. Care to guess what else, besides the spitting beetle, is found only in the Tuscan archipelago?"
Remy answered first.
"Our black rose."
"Right again. We'll have to fill in the timeline, but it seems likely the ink was applied to the labels during Napoleon's stay on Elba.
Or afterward with ink from there, Sam added. Either way, it's another piece in the puzzle.
Well, here's another one, Selma said. Our bottle appears to be something of an onion wrapped in a riddle. The leather label is not one piece, but two layers pressed together. I managed to peel away the top layer without causing any damage.
And?
There's no ink present, but more etchings. A grid of symbols, 8 across and 4 down for a total of 32.
What kind of symbols?
You name it. Everything from alchemy to Cyrillic to astrology and everything in between. My guess? They're customized shape codes with no connection to their origin.
Sam, you're probably familiar with shape code?
He was. During his training at the CIA's Camp Perry, they'd spent 3 days on cryptographic history.
It's essentially a substitution cipher, he explained to Remy. He grabbed a pad and pen from the nightstand and quickly sketched 3 symbols. White square, black diamond, white circle.
Sam said, now suppose the first symbol represents the letter C, the second A, the third T.
Cat, Remy said.
Seems pretty simplistic.
It is, in a sense, but in another sense it's a virtually unbreakable code. The military uses a version of it, something called a one-time pad. The theory is this. 2 people have an encoding-decoding book. One sends a message using shape codes, the other deciphers it by substituting letters for shapes. Without a book, all you've got is random symbols. To anyone else, they're meaningless.
And we don't have a book, Remy said.
Nope.
Selma, can you send us on the way as we speak?
It's not the original picture I took of the label, but Wendy used a vector drawing program to recreate some of the symbols. This'll be just a sample.
A moment later, Sam's email beeped and he called up the image of 8 shapes.
As for decoding it, I might have an idea about that.
At least a place to start, Selma said.
You remember the mystery man, the major who hired the smuggler Ariane to sail to St. Helena?
Of course, Remy said.
I think I know who the major is. I ran across an obscure German biography of Napoleon written in the 1840s. In 1779, when Napoleon was 9, he was sent to a French military school, Brienne-le-Château, near Troyes. There he met a boy named Arnaud Laurent, and they became friends. All through École Royale Militaire College, then on to artillery school, and so on, all the way to Waterloo. According to the author, up until the mid-1790s, just before the first Italian campaign, Laurent had been a step ahead of Napoleon in rank. It was said that in private or in close company, Napoleon jokingly called Laurent the Major. Napoleon had several confidants over the years, but none as close as Laurent.
Is there an estate? Sam asked.
An Arnaud Laurent library, by chance?
No such luck. There's not much out there on Laurent, but from what I gather, when he died in 1825, just 4 years after Napoleon, he was buried with what one article referred to as his most prized possession,
which, with any luck, will be a handy-dandy decoder ring, Sam said.
Or book, Remy added.
Selma, where's he buried?
After his army was routed at Waterloo, Napoleon's surrender was accepted aboard the HMS Bellerophon, along with Napoleon's staff, which I'm guessing included Laurent, who was at the time his chief military advisor. Afterward, the Bellerophon sailed to Plymouth, where after a 2-week wait, Napoleon was transferred to the HMS Northumberland, alone, with no staff, for the final voyage to St. Helena. When Laurent died, his widow, Marie, asked the British for permission to have him buried on St. Helena next to Napoleon, but they refused, so she did what she thought was next best thing. She had him laid to rest on Elba.
Strange, Remy said. It's poetic, Sam replied. Laurent's general, his best friend, had died in exile and been buried in exile. His widow had chosen a spot of... Sam searched for the right word. Symbolic solidarity. Remy tilted her head at her husband. That's beautiful, Sam. I have my moments. Selma, Napoleon's remains. Weren't they moved from St. Helena? They were. Interesting story itself, really. In 1830, the Bourbons, who retook the throne after Napoleon's defeat at Waterloo, were themselves overthrown by the Orléans dynasty. They were a little more nostalgic over Napoleon, so they petitioned the British for permission to bring him home. After 7 years of wrangling, the Brits agreed and the remains were fetched from St. Helena and returned to Paris. His official grave is under the dome of Les Invalides. Laurent's grave is still on Elba. It's a crypt, actually. The trick is, how do you handle it? I assume you'd prefer to avoid breaking in and playing Tomb Raiders. Ideally, Sam said. Then you've got to get permission. And as luck would have it, Laurent has a granddaughter, 5 or 6 times removed, living in Monaco. Ah, Monaco in the spring, Sam murmured. How can we say no? We can't, Remy chimed in.